This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
Hey Alison, do you think I could be a playwright?
Who do you think you are?
Hi everyone, you're listening to Thoughts and Theories on ORFM, where I'll delve deeper into the meanings and messages of films, books, TV shows, and more. I'm Asha Amma Asri, and let's get into it. Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Thoughts and Theories. My name is Asha Amma Asri, and today I'm really excited to be joined by a special guest. Hi Alison.
Hi Asha, thank you for having me.
So, tell us about yourself.
My name is Alison Horsley, and I'm a dramaturg, or a script advisor, as you might call it. And I work in the theater, and I help playwrights with their plays. And sometimes cool. I teach, and do lots of other things too.
Right.
And I'm a proud Otapotiite? Dunedinite? Yes.
That accent sounds unfamiliar for a Dunedinite.
Because I live in Corstorphine.
Okay.
I'm an American. I moved here about 10 years ago.
No, sorry.
I know. No, that's okay. I get super excited when people ask if I'm Canadian. But yes, yeah, so I'm an American. I moved here about 10 years ago, and then I moved back to the States, and then I came back again.
Because you felt loyalty to this special place, of course.
I did. Literally, I did. I love it here. Yeah, it's the most beautiful place in the world.
Oh, that's awesome. No, I don't know why I gasped when I said you weren't like a real Dunedinite. Like, I'm not even a native Dunedinite, but it grows on you, you know what I mean?
Oh, heck yeah, yeah. I think very few people are, you know, like, I think we've all made our way here. You know, in one way or another. So.
100%. I guess, I suppose that begs the question, right? Like, where you belong and, like, you know, where you think where your heart belongs in terms of, like, your past and, like, your identity is. So is it the surrounding that you are in, or is it who you surround with, right?
Right. I think it's a combination of all of the above. Like, I think I'm originally from Texas, and though I have no intention of ever living in Texas again, there is a part of me that will always feel more at home in Texas simply because it's familiar and because that's where a lot of my family is and that's where some of my close friends are. Mm-hmm. And that's where the best food in the world is.
With Tex-Mex.
So I think that feels like home to me in a lot of ways. And I think I will always be a proud Texan. I think that's a trademark of being a Texan, weirdly.
Right.
But there's a big part of me that loves Colorado, which is where I lived for most of my adult life. Mm-hmm. And then there's a big part of me that loves the East Coast of the U.S. Because it's witchy and spooky and wonderful and old. And I love that. But then when I came to Dunedin, I felt a different sense of belonging and a different sense of a place that just felt beautiful, and the natural beauty and the accessibility of it. And there's something about the harbor and the hills, and you feel kind of held here.
Yeah.
In a way.
It feels very grounded.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels, it's so green. I love the proximity to the water. It just, all of those things. So I think here, and also the people I've surrounded myself with, some of whom I knew in Denver, actually. So that's how I came here in the first place, was seeing friends who had moved here. And so I think it's all of the above.
Right. Yeah. No, I definitely agree. Like, I think with different like phases of life. Like you call different parts home. Just as like as you grow up and you change as a person and you pick up new hobbies, that doesn't mean like you discard those old parts of yourself. So with places, I think it's the same thing. So I definitely agree with what you say.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And I think with working in the theater, I remember the first time I walked into the Court Theater in Christchurch. That was when I first moved here. I moved here to work at this job at the Court Theater. Mm-hmm. And they were in their new theater, the Shed in Addington. And the first time I walked into that foyer, I felt like I was at home because I was at a theater and I knew how it worked. And I was like, oh, yeah, I know who that guy is. I know who that lady is. Oh, yeah, that's that person. That's that thing. That's that place. And it just felt like home. So I feel like anywhere in the world where you go, the theater always feels like home, at least to me. Yeah. And I imagine for a lot of people, it's similar types of things, restaurants or music venues or whatever.
100%. Yeah. Which actually goes great into our next topic, because the reason why I brought you on here is because of, you know, what you do, you know. You mentioned dramaturg before. Could you explain that to anyone who doesn't know?
Yeah, totally.
I definitely know what that means. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So dramaturgy is dramaturgy is a noun. It's the art of storytelling or of analyzing aspects of storytelling. So narrative and understanding structure. And so a dramaturg, though in some other languages, dramaturg actually means playwright. A dramaturg in English means you're a person who works with playwrights and you're kind of the nerd of the theater in a way.
Right.
So some people term it an in-house critic. So when I've worked at different theaters, my job varied from reading the scripts that got submitted to the theater to help the artistic director to decide the season. So sort of like a curator of sorts.
Okay, okay.
So if the artistic director was like, we need a comedy with five people or fewer in it that feels kind of like a classic, find it. This is in varying stages of the internet and development. So I had to actually know a lot of stuff and have read a lot of plays to then be able to say, oh, actually, you know, the French playwright Feydeau has some really great comedies that feel classic, but they can be adapted for contemporary audiences. So like, so I'm the nerd who's supposed to know stuff. And then with playwrights, I can listen to a playwright talk about what they are trying to do. And often I can be like an ideas bouncer or a person who helps to tease out the ideas. So often I'm the first person who reads a script outside of a playwright.
Okay.
And so I can then give them feedback like, oh, yeah, this part makes a lot of sense. Oh, I think you need to tease this part out a little more, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
But I approach it with a more of a background of having read a lot of plays.
Okay.
So
if it can be staged, right?
Yeah. And if it can be staged and if it can't, to, I guess, understand how theater works well enough to know if it really can't or if there are some creative solutions that could be found with it. Because, like, there are some plays that you read it and you go, there's no way this could possibly be staged.
Right.
But that's kind of part of the fun challenge.
Yeah.
So I think it's knowing, is it a challenge like that? Or is it a challenge like, okay, this literally can't happen in real time in a theater. It needs to just be a movie.
Yeah.
Which is just another thing altogether.
Right. Oh, so like a manuscript for a play and a movie would be quite different then.
Definitely different. Yeah, it's because a play script needs to be conceived in a way that it has to literally happen chronologically in front of people in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be achievable by a creative team of people who come together to make something with a shared sense of vision. Whereas with film, it's very similar, but film can happen, you know, you can have a million different scenes in a film, lots of different locations. Scenes can be like 10 seconds long, 20 seconds long, stuff like that. Whereas it's a lot harder to accomplish something like that if you're trying to do that in theater, simply because you really only have lighting and like the speed of movement at your disposal.
That
you know?
Is true. Yeah.
Like I've worked on one show that was written more like a film because the scenes were so short, but also it was originally staged being completely flexible.
Right.
And so they knew that there wouldn't be any scene changes or things like that. People would just be like running on and running off. And there's a moment with a rolling chair where literally somebody just pushes somebody on stage in the rolling chair for an office scene and that they push themselves back off.
Oh, okay.
So because it has to happen so fast.
Right.
So it's about the way that actual human people can move in time and space in a live theater, which is just different from how it works in film.
Yeah.
And I think because a lot of people with teaching playwriting and screenwriting, which I specialize way more in the playwriting side, but like often I think we learn storytelling nowadays by watching films and TV. So often people conceive of stories like it's on screen.
Right.
And we forget that the thing has to be acted out in front of us by like human people.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so, 100%.
Yeah, yeah. So it's a difference in the scope of storytelling.
Right. Yeah, no, fair. I'm going to ask you a question. This is a bit like off topic, right?
Woohoo. I love it. Curveball.
No, I usually like, I don't know. Anyone who's listened to me for a while knows that Thoughts and Theories has like a starting topic and then it it can go like from talking about playwriting to, I don't know, bananas or something. Like
I love it. Yeah. I have opinions.
And we love to hear them here. So when it comes to watching movies, right, what do you think about like, I don't know, because this could just be me, but like how the rise in CGI and things like that, do you think it like especially in like fantasy, like do you think it sort of like distances you a little bit more from the like knowledge that these are real people who are acting in front of you and not like animations? Because I feel like, I don't know how to explain it. Like, it feels like it's a live action, but it's not because it feels animated.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. I think it does in a lot of ways. I think it, I don't know, I'm sure scientists who study brains can tell us, but I don't know if it's that different from my generation who grew up watching cartoons versus watching movies. And in movies, I mean, obviously there was Star Wars, so we knew that things in Star Wars weren't real, right? Or we knew that it was like tech type stuff. But in my generation, yeah, we grew up watching, yeah, cartoons and stuff. And so I don't know if maybe that's the same as the way that people relate to CGI now. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Actually, I suppose that's true. Because, like, I don't know, with like Gen Alpha and things like that, they actually do grow up with this, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think it may just be something that they read. I don't know. Maybe it's somewhere in between cartoon world and real people world, that what they're reading somehow or watching sort of fits in a spectrum in between.
Right. Yeah.
But I know that I remember I had a student back in Denver who, you know, loved superhero movies and stuff like that. And he was in an actual fire, right? Like in his apartment complex, there was like an literal fire. And a lady had to jump off of like maybe the second floor or something. And he was like, I'll catch her.
Right? Oh, right. Yep.
Because we see that kind of thing in movies. He underestimated velocity, right. Physics, things like that. I mean, he definitely caught her. Well, she landed on him.
He tried.
He definitely got injured.
Yeah.
But I think that we see certain things and we think that it's doable because we see them.
Yeah.
So I don't know if it's a distancing thing. I mean, they talk about screen as being a cold medium and theater as a hot medium because we respond differently to things happening right in front of us.
Oh, okay.
So like nudity on screen versus nudity in the theater tend to work a little differently because we're more aware, like, oh my gosh, that's a naked person.
Oh my God, what are they doing?
Yeah, what are they doing? That person's actually
legal?
Naked, like in front of me. Yeah, which is just different from seeing it on screen. Also because there's a part of you, I think, on screen who knows that it's a thing that has happened before that's been frozen in time and place. Yep. We know if you touch the screen, you can't touch the person.
Yeah.
And I imagine nowadays with VR and all kinds of other things, there's a whole other thing happening with our brains.
Right, I forgot about VR.
Oh my gosh, right?
Yeah,
like that's a whole other thing. But I think that there's a big difference in seeing things on screen and understanding how we relate to them and our proximity to them versus seeing something live and knowing, oh, okay, actually, if I threw something at that actor on stage, they would stop what they're doing and they would have to respond. Like, there's this weird phenomenon of people throwing stuff at, like, performers at concerts.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Like, this was, like, a thing.
Yes, it was. And, like, when I was, like, studying theater in high school, I remember first learning about, like, you know, about, like, Victorian theater and Elizabethan theater and things like that, and like there was no such thing as the fourth wall and stuff like that, and like how the seatings had like different rankings of like social status, and how you can expect the crowd in like a theater scene to be like you would at like a pub or something like that. Like it's so, and I'm like, that's so bizarre.
Yeah, yeah. The people aren't quiet. There's people talking and there's people like plying various trades. We'll just leave it there in the theater, you know, and people have like fruit and nuts and all kinds of stuff. And that stuff is not quiet.
That's true. Like with like melodrama and stuff, like they did involved. Boo, yippee, you know, like you can really hear the audience interactions, which is actually interesting.
Yeah, yeah. And like the first musicals, for example, were different lyrics written to familiar songs. Right. So the audience could sort of sing along when this started, as opposed to nowadays, there's an expectation that you stay quiet when you're in the theater. Like maybe unless you're in a musical and then people maybe stand up or sing along or whatever, depending on what it is. But the environment is so, I don't know, set in stone
that
now.
Is true.
But I think now theaters are starting to break down more of those barriers to try and get people into the theater who haven't felt welcome before because it was too quiet or because it was too, you know, whatever. So I think we're seeing a welcome breakdown of some of those things again in a way, I think, to open up some of the barriers so it's a bit more accessible, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, like, I feel like a lot of people have like this sort of like aversion to theater that they don't have with movies.
Oh,
I was going to ask like why you think that is.
Oh, I think that we theater people have created it in a lot of ways. Like I blame us.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because I think people don't know this is me saying this, making a lot of assumptions, but I think that some folks feel like they don't belong at a theater, like it's not a place for them. You know, automatically, my whole life that I've worked in the theater, I've been doing theater since I was 12 years old. And so the whole time, whenever I've said, oh, I do stuff in the theater, you know, if it's a non-theater person, often they'll be like, oh, the theater, or oh, Shakespeare, or something like that.
Exactly, that's true.
Yeah,
yeah.
You know,
it's always Shakespeare.
It's always Shakespeare. Or I say, oh, I work in the theater, and they go, oh, fun!
That's a real job.
Yeah, yeah. Like what we do is pretending to be cats all day long.
Or
where we're sitting here and I'm like, Asha, be an elephant, you know, like or something like that, as opposed to like thinking and having plays and scripts and stories. And yeah. So I think that we've cultivated some high culture status thing with the theater so that people think it's not a place for them and they don't know how to buy tickets, and the tickets are stupid expensive because of operating costs and stuff like that, because you do have to pay the live actors who are doing things and the live stagehands, whereas with a film or something on screen you have the initial expenditure and then maybe the PR around it and stuff like that, but then you have the thing.
Yep.
You don't need people to keep making the thing over and over again the way that you do with theater. So a lot of people don't understand that what you're paying for is you're paying to see and to see these people do it live in front of you and to sustain these careers.
Yeah.
And it's a lot cheaper to just watch something at home. I mean, it's a different feeling altogether. And like if you watch something at home, you don't get that sense of community.
That's true. I genuinely feel like people just need to give it a go at least once so that they can feel the difference, right?
Yeah, yeah, because it's not like what you've seen on TV, and it's not – and like – and these places, like I remember when I've tried to go to new venues before, my first questions are how do I buy a ticket? Where do I park? Are there bathrooms? Are there things I can eat? Like what if I get hungry? I don't know where to sit. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I can turn off my phone. These are all totally normal questions.
Yeah.
And I think in the past, theater created an environment where everybody who went like automatically knew all the rules.
Right.
And
yeah.
So it's hard to get into that. But that's actually not how it is anymore. So you actually can go to a theater not knowing what the rules are. All you have to do is like park or take the bus or whatever and go. And you buy a ticket just like you buy a ticket for a movie or whatever. You scan a thing at the door. They let you in. There's bathrooms. There's, you know, treats. I don't know, the bathrooms and treats are key.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think we've created all these barriers that I don't think have served us very well.
Yeah. And it's actually like a double-edged sword, right?
Yeah. 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 And theater people are like nice and normal and they're not snooty. There's nobody there who's going to be snooty because everybody's going to be like excited to see an audience.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I feel like a lot of people's perceptions are made off of like two things. Either Sharpay from High School Musical or it's Shakespeare from high school.
Yes.
So, like, people's actual experience in school. So
yeah.
Because it is their first experience, they think, okay, everyone's going to be like a mean girl and really over the top like Sharpay.
Yeah.
Or they're going to be like, you know, Shakespeare snobs and it's like really boring because I don't understand what you're saying
right.
Anyway. That's not real English, you know, kind of
yes,
thing.
Yes, totally. Yeah. Totally. And that, and we do, like, for educators too, it's like, I wish that people would teach other stuff. And I know a lot of teachers do teach other mm-hmm. kinds of stuff beyond Shakespeare, because Shakespeare is really wonderful, but Shakespeare only represents a tiny percentage of all of the plays and the playwrights in the world and what's being written about and what has been written about. You know, it, for thousands of years, people have been writing hilarious, crazy, wonky, wacky things that are accessible, and not to dig on Shakespeare, you know, not to...
No, go ahead. That's a safe space.
Yeah, but like, but sometimes it's not as accessible, especially depending on who's performing it. And like, I feel like it's a sign of a successful Shakespeare production if the audience thinks that maybe you did something to the language to make it simpler.
Right, yeah.
Because the people who are performing it understand it so well. Mm-hmm. And I've had that experience where I've worked on a Shakespeare play and the audience like accused us of editing it or of changing it because they understood it. Mm-hmm. And I was like, y'all, that's because we did it well.
but no one's ready to hear about that, right?
yeah, exactly. But it's like, but I think Shakespeare's so hard to read if you're just sitting and reading it and you haven't had experience reading other plays. So if the first play that you ever read in your life is a Shakespeare play, I don't blame you for not wanting to read plays, for heaven's sake. And reading plays is not like an easy thing that a lot of people understand immediately. It's like a muscle that you have to get better at. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's how it is with the theater, except that if you enjoy any part of the experience, if you go to the theater and you enjoy any aspect of it, then you've gotten something out of it, so that then you know if you go back, you might get a little more out of it next time.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't mean that you have to understand everything that's said in the entire 2 hours, and if you don't, then you're dumb, or like, oh well, you failed at theater. You know, it means that it's you opening up your world and learning a different form of storytelling.
Yeah,
I don't know. I think
as well, like you said earlier, people are afraid to not know what to do when you're watching. Because
oh,
I remember,
yeah.
Like, I watched a Globe play, actually.
Oh, yeah.
And this was earlier this year, even. And I've studied theater for, like, almost 7 years now, even if it's, like, you know, not, like, full-time. And so you'd think I would know, you know? But I didn't realize it was an intermission and not the ending, because I just didn't understand. Like, it was a Shakespeare play. I was just like,
yeah.
You know, I've been studying this for so long, I still don't know what's going on. But hey, it looks like things have ended. People are standing up. So I'm just going to go leave. And then my friend's like, oh, are you going to the bathroom? Are you coming back? And I'm like, I'm going home. And she's like, no, it's not done yet. And I'm like, oh, I knew that.
Yeah. But that's, yeah. And that's the thing. And we don't want to feel stupid. And we want to, you know, we're often afraid of having that experience. And I would say that is partly a problem of the production. If the production wasn't clear enough that more was going to be going on, then that's a fault of the production, too.
Right, yeah.
You know, like, yeah. So it's not you as an audience member. Like, but yeah, we, and because of what we've cultivated with theater being theater or whatever, then yeah, automatically people think if you go to the theater for the first time and you don't get it, and then you think it just reinforces whatever the prejudice is that you might have of, oh, this isn't a place for me.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm freaking, you know, I'm 49 years old. And like I said, I've been doing this since I was 12. And there are often times that I don't know what's going on. And I'm like, is it just me? Is it only me? And I teach this stuff.
Right. Yeah.
You know, so I think it never ends. But I think it's about allowing yourself to have a sense of wonder and curiosity to know that you're not going to do something so wrong that, I mean, don't kill anybody, you know, but like
yeah.
other, and like maybe don't say anything really loud during the performance to distract other people in the audience from being able to hear the thing happening.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are certain things that you shouldn't do, but, and those aren't necessarily a snobby theater thing. They're more of a human civilization thing, you know, where it's like, hey, there's other people here, you know, mm-hmm. trying to listen to a thing. So I think that's where we've gone wrong is I think we've taken some of those rules to the extreme and given people a sense that maybe it's not for them.
Right. Anyone listening? That means you need to go to theater.
Yeah, try it. And often
it's not like an exclusive club.
No, it's not. Yeah. No. I am so basic, you guys. Like, seriously.
No.
I am not an exclusive person. Like, and the fact that I feel okay going and walking into any theater, and you don't have to wear certain things, too.
Yeah.
Like, especially in New Zealand, like, it's very casual. You don't have to, like, put on your ball gown or whatever. Like, you don't have to dress up. You don't have to do anything special. Like, you probably will need to silence your phone.
Yeah.
But sometimes you don't have to, and that's part of the show. So, and they'll tell you that, too. And you can always ask any person who's there, like an usher or whatever, if there's anybody there, you can ask and be like, hey, is it okay if I'm on my phone during this? And they may be like, no. And then you deal with that.
Yeah.
You know?
It's all about asking questions, right?
Yeah. Just
putting
ask the questions.
Out there, be brave.
Be brave. Like, nobody's going to kill you for asking the question. Like, they're excited. Like, theater can only happen if there's an audience.
That's true.
And if we, yeah. So please come to the theater. Like, we need you. And you might discover that you really love it. And you might end up doing some of it later, even.
Exactly, yes.
Know?
Which, speaking of, when did you first start into theater? Because you said you started studying when you were 12, was it?
Yeah, I took my first theater class when I was 12. And it was not intentional at all. It was because I was in what we called the seventh grade in the States. So I was 12. And I was in a Spanish class, and I did not like the teacher. And my mother called the school and asked what other classes I could be in. And there was a quote-unquote communications class that was being offered at the same time. And so my mom put me in the communications class, which was actually a theater class. And so the first day I walked in and they were doing improv, and I liked it. And the teacher said that I was good at it. She was complimentary. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And so I just stayed. And so that's how it happened. It wasn't like I had some epiphany. You know, I didn't see a stage and I was like, I have to do that. You know,
it was my calling in life.
Yeah, this is my calling. Like, it was more like it was a convenience thing. And again, it was about taking a step that was a little step. Yeah. You know, it's not like I decided, to enter the career. You know, I decided to not take the Spanish class, but take the communications class.
Yeah, it's all about perspective.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one small step at a time.
One little thing. Yeah. And that's how our lives are often. It's just like one little thing. And like, yeah, so I did it. And I had an encouraging teacher, honestly. And that's
very important.
Yeah. Yes. And that's and so that's what happened. And then like over time, repeatedly, at different phases of my life, I did some version of that type of step where I was like, oh, well, I could do a little more theater, or I could do this other thing. Oh, I'll do the other thing. Oh, whoops, I ended up doing a little more theater, you know, and it just sort of kept happening.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So, it was very natural.
It wasn't like a straight line, was it?
Oh my gosh, yeah. No. It is like the most curvy, jagged line. I've left multiple times. I've quit theater multiple times.
Right, but you keep coming back to it.
I know.
Like
it's like the Godfather. Seriously, okay, like so many other theater people have said the same thing where they're like, I'm done with this. This is ridiculous. You know, because you get it, you know, because you do it for the love. And then once it becomes a job, sometimes you start to view it differently.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you get to do it as a job, it's a luxury, or you're told it's a luxury that you get to do what you love, and that's a luxury. And so then you feel guilty if you get burned out doing it because it's been such a luxury to do what you love. So then you get angry, and then you do something else, and then you're like, actually, no, I love theater,
right,
and this is what makes sense to me. So that's a pretty common. Common trajectory from what I understand.
Right.
So it was only in New Zealand, actually, that I think because of the culture here, it's a place that is more permissive to try things.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think like in the States, people, you tend to get kind of locked into what you do and there's an expectation that you keep doing it.
Right.
Whereas I think in New Zealand, at least my perception is there's a bit more openness. And so it's only been in New Zealand that I've done other non-theater things since I started doing theater.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that, because that was something I just didn't feel like I could do in the States. It was only here that I've like been a bartender and, you know, done these other things. And most of it was out of necessity, but it was also out of I don't know, just personal growth and going, yeah, yeah. Hey, what else is
it's
there?
It's a new experience, and you always learn something from anything that comes your way, right?
So. Oh, absolutely.
Well, I'm glad you got to get that experience while you're here.
Yeah. Hey, I'm renewing my duty manager's license as we speak.
Nice.
You know?
I was like, is the renewing process, like, hard? Or is it just like, no, hey, I want to renew?
You get one. Oh, my gosh. I hope I'm not going to get in trouble for saying this. I think you get one automatic renewal, and then the one that I'm doing requires me to answer questions
to make
sure that I still am current in the knowledge.
Yeah.
But then I just answer
the
questions.
You're not a fraud.
I'm not a fraud. I know. My whole life, I felt like a fraud. For young people listening, if you feel like a fraud, you're in good company. We all feel like frauds.
Yes, that's true.
Just
imposter
FYI.
Syndrome.
Imposter syndrome is real.
Yep.
And especially, yeah. Yeah, imposter syndrome is real. I've had it my entire life. A little less often now, I think that someone in the back is going to stand up and be like, I'm a such and such expert and you're a fraud. Like I'm pointing
you're
at
wrong.
You're wrong. Honestly, like literally 20 years now, I've been convinced that's going to happen. In like a talk back, if I'm hosting a talk back, it started when I worked on an Albee play. Edward Albee, who's an American playwright. I like worked on this Albee play and he was still alive at the time. And I had this fear that I'd be running a talk back. And he was a very intense man.
Right.
And like a very scary intellectual kind of man. And I was always worried I'd be running a talk back and he was going to stand up in the back or somebody would stand up and be like, I'm an Edward Albee expert and you're wrong.
Like, actually, that's not how you would stage that.
Yes. My whole life. And you guys, like, I have a fancy degree in this and I've taught at universities about this. And if I think, yeah. So, yeah, don't be afraid of trying any of this stuff because we're all still scared.
Yeah.
Realistically.
Yeah.
We're all still scared and we all still feel like frauds. Yeah. You just get to be an old wrinkly fraud.
God, I love that.
That's the only difference.
That is great advice, though. And on that note, we'll have our short break for now. So for our live listeners, we've got a song picked by Allison called LaGrange.
Yes.
LaGrange by ZZ Top. Would you like to explain why you chose this song in particular?
Yes. Well, it goes back to that Texan-ness. So it has a pretty rich history behind it. It's kind of PG, maybe PG-13, but ZZ Top is the little old band from Texas. So,
all right,
yeah,
awesome, and we'll see
you
guys in a wee bit. And welcome back, guys. I hope you guys enjoyed that song. Okay, so we're halfway through the episode, and I wanted to go back to where we started, which was you being in the playwriting business and being a dramaturg and things like that, right?
Yeah.
So you were an actor for a wee while, but clearly you went behind the scenes.
I went behind the scenes very quickly. as soon as I found out about dramaturgy, I was like, I'm gone.
See you guys.
See you. No more acting.
Right. No. Fair enough. So you found like a love for it pretty quickly. What is it about it that like drew you to it?
Well, I think so. At the time, I was at university and I was acting, and that's because I didn't know anything else that I was good at. Honestly,
right.
I knew I was not good at the tech side of things. I knew I didn't really have much of a gift in terms of design or whatever, and I liked performing. And so I remember I was in a summer production at the university where I went in Denver, and. You know, it was like a little student group that would just do productions in the summertime in the black box at the theater because it wasn't occupied. So we were doing a little production and I was acting in it. And the director of it, I remember we went out afterward. I even remember like where we were, the bar where we were
in Denver. This is a core memory.
Like this is a core memory. And he was like, what is it that you like doing about acting? And I was like, I really like doing all the background research because for this role, I had done all this research on types of movies that were referenced and what the vibe was of the movie that then influenced the play. And, and he was like, well, you know, there's like a whole career where you just do the background research stuff and you don't act. And I was like, tell me more.
Say less.
Yeah, say less. Yeah. And so when I found out about the version of dramaturgy I first found out about was doing all the background research.
Right.
So, you know, the idea of working on a play that's, I mean, to use Shakespeare as an example, but like for like Romeo and Juliet, right? So we know it's like the world's greatest love story, blah, 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 blah. It's set in Verona, which is in Italy. And so in my earlier days of being a dramaturg, my job would have been to like research that part of Italy and find out what life would have been like in Verona at the time. And was it weird to have two people in love at that age, or was it like pretty common, you know, for a girl to get married at, you know, whatever age Juliet is, you know, like, so the researchy, nerdy stuff is the stuff I really loved. And so as soon as I found out about that, that was the light bulb moment for me where I was like, bam, wow, I would love to do that for my whole life. I could do that my whole life and be happy. And it was the weirdest thing. And I didn't think I could get paid for it. And I didn't know what a career would look like in it. But I knew that people did it and did that along with other things. So I ended up going a lot more into that. So I started when I was at uni, actually.
Right.
And it wasn't until later that I found out more about the new playwriting side of things. I went to graduate school in dramaturgy, or postgrad, as it's called here, and that was the first time I worked with a playwright who was writing a play at the time, as opposed to just taking a play and doing all the background research on it. And so those two things started going hand in hand, where I did like the research and then also working with a playwright and then starting to learn like how to work at a theater to then give context to the audience. So the dramaturg is often also the person who does the program notes.
Yeah.
So you're the context person.
Right.
So you're the context person sometimes for a playwright, sometimes for the actors, sometimes for the audience.
Right. So did you actually ever consider writing as well as doing background research and stuff?
I never did, actually. I took a playwriting class when I was in college at uni, and I didn't even finish the play that I was writing. So having just come off a semester teaching at the uni.
Yeah, Allison, I don't know how I feel about this. My entire perception of you has changed.
Don't tell your classmates. But when I was your age, I did not finish my play.
Really? Okay.
So you guys who have taken my playwriting class and who take Amanda's playwriting class at the university, by the way, Amanda Martin, fantastic playwriting professor at University of Otago, who I was subbing for this semester, you guys write more than I did when I was your age. You have written more than I did when I was at your age.
Dang.
Like, yeah, right?
That's kind of crazy.
Yeah. And so, but again, life, you know, like, and so I never did. And I always felt like I feel the same about directing, that like I was not good at directing. I wasn't interested in it. I always said, I want to be the person sitting next to the person driving the bus. And like, I want to be the one telling them where to go.
Yeah,
I don't want to be the one driving it. Like, I'm not a manager. I'm not I'm a leader, but I'm not a leader like that.
Right, right, right.
And I feel similarly as a playwright. Like, I have tried it more recently, and I've written a couple plays. Mostly I've co-written plays.
Right.
And that's a comfortable place for me.
Okay.
And I can structure narratives, and I can structure ideas and stuff. But the writing process, actually, I don't know that that's where my gift is.
Yeah, no, fair enough. Hey, at least you dipped your toes in there.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, yeah, I absolutely have. Yeah. And like, yeah, and so now having done that, I absolutely understand all the playwrights who I've given notes to who were like, just tell me what to write. You know, I absolutely understand that now that I've done it, because I've had people giving me notes and me just wanting to pull my hair out and be like, just tell me what to write. Don't ask me questions about it. Yeah. Don't give me leading questions. Just tell me how to fix it. But I'm at the end of the day, I think I'm a dramaturg.
Awesome.
That's just what it is.
You explored different areas. You went to playwriting, you went to acting and things like that. And now you know where you are, and that's really good.
Yeah. Yeah. I found where my skill is, and it's nice to know where that is.
Awesome.
It's that part's a luxury, actually.
So currently you're working for Play Market, correct?
Yes.
Yes. Is there anything Play Market is doing at the moment, like any competitions that
anyone who...
Because I know in the beginning I was like, can I be a playwright? And you said no. Is that Catherine Wellison. Can
that
I
is
be a
not true. You absolutely can be a playwright. And having read your writing, I would say that you are a playwright.
Oh, God.
And that you should do some more of it.
Ooh.
Dare I say.
Oh, my God.
She,
scary.
You guys, we're in the studio and she actually looks scared.
I am terrified. Hey, this is the imposter syndrome coming in alive. I'm not a real playwright anyway.
Yeah, like I'm not. I was going to say I'm not a real dramaturg. I think I am a real dramaturg finally. I'm a real boy. But Play Market, we are an agency that represents New Zealand playwrights. So mm-hmm. we advocate on behalf of New Zealand playwrights. And I ply my trade on behalf of Play Market. So I, so for our client playwrights, I read their plays and I give them feedback and stuff. And we host a bunch of different competitions during the year because we're essentially a nonprofit organization. We're a service organization. We're funded by Creative New Zealand and Foundation North and all these other places. So we're here to serve artists, basically. So we run one the competition that we have coming up. The deadline is December 1st, and that's for the biggest playwriting award of the year, the Adam Award, which playwrights, it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter how long the play is, it doesn't matter how you've formatted the play. You can submit this play and it will be read by one of the judges and we won't know who wrote it. So we read them blind. And I say we because often I'm one of the readers at some stage, but I don't necessarily read all of them or anything like that. Asha, if you were to enter your play into the Adam Award, I wouldn't necessarily be the one reading it. So we're all good. So that's open to anybody of any age and it's free to enter. And you just go to playmarket.org.nz. So the Adam Award is our upcoming competition. And hey, if you win it, you get like a big fat cash prize. And last year.
Yeah, say less. No,
yeah. Last year, the lady who won it is under the age of 25. She's 24 years old, Alex Medland. So it's not an age thing. We read these blind. The administrator removes people's the playwright's name off the script. So we don't know who wrote it. Mm-hmm. So it's an even playing field. So we have that, and then later on, well, next year we have Plays for the Young, which is plays for younger people. We have plays or playwrights before 25, which is a competition only for people under the ages of 25 or the age 25, and it's done the same way. It's free to enter, and you're only competing against other playwrights who are under 25.
Right.
So we've got that. We have Asian Ink. We have Brown Ink. We have all these different competitions. We have a Theater Makers Award now. So we really just try to create competition opportunities for people to want to encourage them to write plays. And sometimes you need a deadline to finish something.
That is true.
A lot of playwrights around the country use the Adam Award, the December 1st deadline, as their deadline for finishing a play.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah. So tons of opportunities. So, yeah. And we're not the only ones who have competitions. Like the Playwrights Association of New Zealand has competitions for 10-minute plays and short plays.
Yeah.
So tons of stuff out there.
Okay, awesome. Did you hear that, guys? Check out Play Market and you'll be on your way.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you so much, Alison, for coming on to the show. I really appreciate you coming on so last minute as well.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, no problem at all. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
I feel like we could talk
for hours.
Yeah, no, for sure. I feel like I've got so many more questions. I'm like, we could just actually just talk about theater and like playwriting like separately, and they're both like, could be their own episodes.
Oh, my gosh, totally.
Yeah,
totally, totally. And my love for ZZ Top, who wrote LaGrange.
I love that. Is there any last-minute things you wanted to add before we head off?
No, just don't be afraid to write and don't be afraid to go to the theater. Try it. You know, you're going to find something out that you love.
Awesome. Thank you so much. As you know, guys, please take care of yourself and pay attention to the news. Please boycott Coca-Cola, Starbucks, and Disney. Thank you so much. Free Palestine. Thank you all for joining me today on Thoughts and Theories. I hope you've learned something new or taken away something to think about. I hope to see you all next time. Till then, this has been Thoughts and Theories with Asha Amaasri.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.